her story is so fascinating that we might ask you to sort of speculate about where Mr. Tucker got this vision of this remarkable automobile and how he brought it to fruition.
Well, I think possibly, I don't know this for a fact, but I think possibly he was a frustrated person, like anyone who ever worked in automobile design was frustrated, because I think earlier I mentioned that a car could be designed in toto, and when it came back from engineering, there were so many changes made that one would hardly recognize one's own design. And it's entirely possible that Tucker was a little bit tired of having one new idea come in this year and another new idea, but never anything totally new. And he had probably, I'm speculating, from time to time, would like to have seen a car that would have had certain, could do certain things, would have certain features. And so he wanted to put them all together in one car to see how it would be, that one could have a whole new concept of automobile. And when he came up with all these ideas, they were new, such as the Cyclops eye.
Yes.
The front end moved separately from the back of the car when the wheels were turned, where the front wheels would do certain things, and so on and so forth. All independent suspension, too. We wanted everything slightly independent of each other. Certain types of brake systems. I think he wanted the disc brakes to come in. He was a great man, not only for speed and aerodynamic designs. I think he wanted safety.
Yes.
They wanted to put safety belts in cars right from the start, but they didn't dare do it because people would think, well, they're putting safety belts in, the car isn't safe. So they had to do it differently. So that's why he cleaned out the interior of the car, and the crash pads concept came, so that in case of a roll, there was something to catch the force of the roll.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the protrusion of knobs and toggle switches and all that sort of thing, I think, was probably abhorrent to him.
They're all recessed.
And everything was recessed.
Yeah.
And in fact, it reminds me of one year my mother had a new car and she was taking it out for a drive, and she had my little brother in the back seat. She hit a patch of ice and the car went into a spin and hit the curb, and my brother hit the instrument panel and smashed the whole front of his face in. So this sort of thing was not to happen with a Tucker. That crash pad was to prevent all that. Also, there was the floor was recessed because of the type of engine that it had, and it got rid of that long drive shaft that went from the front to the back. And
was it rear engine? Transverse?
I think it was a transverse. I'm not sure, but I think it was a transverse. Anyway, that drive shaft just disappeared, it was supposed to be sort of like an escape basement or something that one could get into if a crash were imminent, that type of thing. So
it was really a startling innovation.
The whole thing was different, and it was low. It was sleek. It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we had our convention this past year, I rode in one from the Sheraton Hotel over to the storage garage, and people were staring. This today.
One of the original torpedoes.
Yes. Oh, it was a beautiful one. It was in blue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful car. You could see all the features there and how clean it was, and just an entirely different concept.
Well, he really is a remarkable pioneer, that he was able to take all of the innovations that had just come out that people weren't using, like disc brakes and independent suspension. You can get these from Europe and other places, and roll them into a remarkably new package.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first contact with Mr. Tucker?
Well, after the company got started in Cicero, Illinois, I had a brother who had been a salvage engineer for General Motors.
Had he picked up the old Dodge plant by this
time? Yes, he
Dodge
had that.
Airplane plant or whatever it was? Tank plant?
It's a Dodge something or other, and the Tucker was starting out by leasing it from the government, and I think they found that they could buy it.
It was in Cicero.
Cicero. Mm-hmm. And I had a brother who was working there, and I had at that time come back home from my different kinds of job seeking and gotten a job back at the university hospital, and my brother called me and he said, I think you ought to go over to Illinois and take a look at that Tucker, that car. He said, I think that's something that you'd like to get into. So I asked him if he knew who was in charge, and he didn't know Alex, but he knew the man in charge of personnel, and he gave me his name. And I've kind of forgotten it, but it seems to me his name was Wilson. Mm-hmm. And he said, I think if you call him, he could probably tell you who's in charge of the styling. So I called, and he told me it was Alex Tremulous was in charge of that department. So I called him and talked with him, and he asked me to come to Chicago and bring some samples of my work that he'd mm-hmm. heard that yeah. Lloyd had a woman working for him.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And so he said,
that'd
be kind of interesting.
What had been Alex's background in the pre-war years? Had he
gosh.
Been on the fringes of automotive design in those days?
Oh, yes, he'd been, I think he was doing race cars.
Race cars.
I think that's what he had been doing.
But he knew that he'd heard about you working for the
mm-hmm. very... Oh, yes, he'd heard about that. So he thought that'd be kind of interesting. He said, we need somebody to do some interiors for us. And although interiors hadn't been my fort, it was something that I had done also.
Sure.
So...
He'd worked on them in design school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I went down and I took some drawings, and Alex hired me on the spot and mm-hmm. helped me find a place to live. And I came home, packed up, and went back down. And it
Where'd
was...
Where'd you live?
I lived on... South Shore Drive. One of Tucker's secretaries had an apartment, and she was willing to take me in as a roommate. And it was a beautiful address and a beautiful location overlooking the lake, and it was really quite delightful. We got blasted in the winter with a lot of heavy snow and that sort of thing, but it still was a good place to be.
You commute to Cicero.
Yeah, we drove. She had a car, and she said I could live with her if I would guarantee that I would drive part of the time rather than have her do all the driving.
Even though you didn't have an automobile, you learned to drive?
Oh, I knew how to drive. I learned to drive when I was 12 years old.
Sure.
You talk about going for rides on Sunday afternoons. When we went for rides, they were working rides. My mother made us all learn to drive.
Good for her.
So, but it was an experience in itself, too, driving in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we had to drive through the Black Belt, which was quite an interesting experience.
South Side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because we had to go through to Cicero.
The old Capone hangout.
Right. But it all worked out very well, as long as it lasted. And it was very enjoyable. I enjoyed working with...
Don't confess. What did you actually do in terms of interior design?
Well, again, I worked on, made drawings for interiors. Now there I did work with colors. Fabric samples and also color chips, coordinating the interior colors with exterior colors, which was something else again that was quite new, because up to that point there hadn't been too much concern about color of interiors. Mm-hmm. They didn't worry about colors, didn't worry about fabrics. There was just like one fabric, and it was that
blend.
Oh, yes.
Those old gray mohairs.
And they just clung to your clothes terribly. So we were interested in trying to use some different kinds of fabrics.
Kind of new fabric did you
Well, I can't recall the names of them, but I can still see them, and I can still feel them. They looked like suede, but they were woolen. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful fabrics. Just beautiful. And it was nice working with vendors and uh-huh. seeing what they had, and working with the boys from the trim shop and uh-huh. to see what they could do for us.
Sure.
That sort of thing.
So you were pretty much in charge of interior styling?
Yes, I did. Did designs for door panels and seat covers mm-hmm. and coordinating the lines of the seat covers to the door panels and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about the dashboard?
I didn't do any of the work on the dashboard.
Was that separate?
And that was separate. That was a separate thing. And it was already pretty well established that this is what they wanted, and the instruments were pretty well established in a cluster group in front of the steering wheel. There wasn't an instrument of any kind or any hardware in front of the passenger. In fact, the glove compartment was in the door instead of having a glove compartment in the instrument panel there. They took the glove compartment out of there and put it in the door. And so there wasn't anything that could hurt one. Everything was recessed. Mm-hmm.
Remarkable that he was such an advocate of safety in those
mm-hmm.
days when it was... As you say, it wasn't even whispered that
mm-hmm.
cars would be mm-hmm. safe, even though racing drivers and airplane mm-hmm. pilots had been using them for years.
Mm-hmm. I read an article a couple of years or so ago about a young fellow, written by a young fellow from Canada, who was making some pretty interesting guesses on the number of lives that could have been saved had this car gone into production because of the way people die in an automobile accident. The things within a car that kill people.
Especially children. You, of course, were very much in favor of this.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You felt it was a visionary, but it must be.
It's a wonderful idea.
The padded dashes, too?
Yes, it was padded.
Padded, protected rear.
It was like a roll. It went all the way around. I don't recall how the rear view mirror looked.
That was a later innovation, I think.
And even though I had many sketches, I say my sketches all went to the Coppola studio, so I don't have anything anymore to...
Did you come up with some pretty bold colors? They've been rather stodgy pre-war.
Well, we were working with colors, but however, we didn't come up with anything wild for this reason. Previous experience didn't give us a background for a lot of boldness, for one thing. For another thing, Mrs. Tucker dictated the colors.
Preston's wife
dictated the colors that were to be used.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
And we worked with her ideas, although we didn't work with Mrs. Tucker. The ideas got through to us. As long as it was blue or pink or peach or whatever, that was okay. And black, of course. But blue...
Looking back, the colors are rather basic colors.
That's right. And since this was their car... Their ideas, and we were only to carry out their ideas. This is what we did.
How about fabrics? Did she have any expertise in that line?
I don't know too much about what her expertise was in fabrics, but no, it was made pretty clear that everything had to be compatible and coordinate, right? But as I say, if it were blue, anything that went with blue, and of course we did have some beautiful blue fabrics that went well with her favorite color, which was waltz blue.
Waltz blue.
Was
it light?
Yes.
Light blue.
Lovely blue. In fact, if you saw the car that Norman Knight brought down from Hickory Corners, that is waltz blue. He made everything as authentic as possible. Whether or not he repainted the car, I don't know. The car was old, but it had no more than, I think, 3 miles on it when we saw it. But what happened to the paint job in all these intervening years, I wouldn't know, but that was the authentic waltz blue.
So you did have a chance to make a strike out some new directions with fabrics.
Fabrics, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and color fabrics.
And color fabrics, right.
How about the any of the interior structural design? Did you have, you said you'd made wall panels, door panels.
Door panels, mm-hmm.
Which would probably be diamond shaped.
Well, any whatever you if I just had some of my drawings, I could show you the variety of ideas that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many of those ideas were carried out, I have no way of knowing. But I did submit drawings to the trim department, and we would see the doors and things and seats after they finished them. It was very nice. They did lovely work.
So, in effect, the trim department was executing your designs.
Oh yes,
for the interior.
In fact, it was very gratifying to see how well they followed our ideas.
Did they?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of fabrics did you use? Do you remember?
Well, they were woolen fabrics mostly, and we didn't have leather. I think we might have had some vinyl, but it was mostly
early vinyl
and beautiful woolen fabrics. But they were very smooth surfaced. Mm-hmm. They looked almost suede like. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gee, that's great.
Yes, it was nice. So one could just slip from one side of the seat to the other without tearing your clothes off.
Did you use any bolsters or biscuits or anything like that?
No.
It was just a straight bench seat.
Straight bench seat. There would be some sort of indention one way or another, either vertically or horizontally, and maybe a color contrast. Mild, though, it wouldn't have been wild.
What did you use for, what did they use for stuffing?
I really don't know.
That was really out in the trim
department. Yeah, it was all in the trim department, and I never saw any of that. One of the interesting features of the automobile, and this was also one of Mr. Tucker's ideas, he wanted the front and back seat cushions interchangeable so that the wear would be distributed evenly if one were turning in a car or selling it, that the seats would be worn so evenly that there wouldn't be any distinction of wear.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a pretty good idea.
Mm-hmm. So this is in 47?
I think it must have been about 47, right?
47.
Mm-hmm.
And the car is causing a lot of talk, an awful lot of publicity about it.
Mm-hmm.
And are you about ready to go into production at this point?
Yes, I think they had, at the time I arrived there, however, they hadn't produced a car. In fact, when I came from the airport to the Tucker Corporation the first day that I was to report to work, the cab driver pulled up at a light, and when he found out that I was going out to Tucker to work, he said, "Oh, that's a fabulous car." So he told me an incident previously, how he had been out driving and had stopped at a light, and this car came up, and he said, "Never seen anything like it." And he said, when that light changed, he said it was like a rocket. It just took off. I was still there. He said, it was just like a rocket.
This is a drivable prototype, perhaps?
This was the cab driver talking. So when I got out to the building, I was telling Alex about this wild car and what it could do, and he said, "Let me show you the Tucker." So we went out to the showroom, and he showed me this beautiful car sitting there, and he said, "There it is." I said, "Is that the one that the fellow was talking about?" He said, "Must be." So we looked at it, and it was a mock-up, and it was made of wood. Wood, metal, clay, whatever they could get. There wasn't much clay because they couldn't get the vendors to sell them any clay. I suppose the big three refused to allow the vendors to sell clay to Tucker. They needed it so badly to make their models. So it was mostly anything. It was really a junk pile.
Mm-hmm.
But it was beautifully painted, beautifully shaped and styled. And he said that's the one that left him like a rocket. So it was in the imagination of people that Tuckers were around and what they could do, and here there wasn't one out there yet.
You didn't have a driver?
There really wasn't, no.
Oh, okay.
No, there wasn't. It was just his wild imagination.
Isn't it harmless?
Yes. But then after the cars did get into production, Alex and sometimes Phil Egan, who was the other fellow in the styling section, and Noble, mostly Noble.
What was
Noble
his name?
Tucker.
No. Oh, no.
Noble Tucker.
Brother?
He was the son of...
Oh, son of Preston.
He was the second son of Preston.
Mm-hmm.
And see, there was Preston Jr., then Noble, and John.
Mm-hmm.
But Preston Noble was the one that always liked to hang around the styling section.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very affable, just a delightful young fellow. And we'd go out in the parking lot, and we'd take the cars and do some wild things with
mm-hmm.
them. And I know that it could perform, but we didn't take it out on the highway.
You're there, and you're working in the interior styling. How long did it take before the first production model, bearing your design?
Well, now this I can't even tell you. I can't tell you because the first production models did not have my design.
Okay.
Everything was in the works when I arrived. Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't see anything at that time assembled, they were in the works. And as I say, even today I don't know what cars had my designs on. I can't remember, and I have no way now even of finding out.
Can you look at that Tucker today, like last summer, and mm-hmm. say, "That's something I did"?
No, I can't.
Really?
I couldn't tell you because I made so many.
A door panel or?
I did so many designs, I couldn't tell you.
Uh-huh.
If I had my drawings, I could probably.
So it was really compartmentalized. You
mm-hmm.
you worked in effect a vacuum, not a vacuum, but I mean a pleasant. Creative vacuum, but you sent your sketches on to the color and trim department, and they did
the work.
I
right.
See.
And as I say, when I saw the work that they did, I thought it was very nice, but what went into production, I don't recall.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the drawings that I had, that I was able to bring out from Tucker when they closed, those are the things that I sent to the studios.
I see.
And if someone said they brought a car to the convention, did you do this interior? I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
But no, it was very delightful, though. It was a nice place to work. And
yeah, can you tell us a bit of some anecdotes about
Yeah, I can tell you some things.
Yeah,
or at least I can tell you one delightful thing. That
Tremulous and Mr.
Alex, yeah, whoever. Alex and Phil, who was the other designer.
Phil.
Egan.
Mm-hmm.
Alex and Phil and I would go out to the airport. And we would lie down on the ground next to the fence. Did I ever tell you about
yeah.
that? We'd
mm-hmm.
lie down. Alex wanted to tell us about aerodynamics. And he said,
yes.
The best thing you can do is... He said, we can't take you to a wind tunnel, but he said, you kind of get an idea of aerodynamics by watching the planes take off.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go out to Midway Airport, and we would lie on the grass right next to the fence at the end of the runway. We'd lie there and watch these planes go overhead, and you could see the air piles.
Midway, the old city, Chicago City Airport.
And
he would explain what aerodynamics.
He was explaining exactly how it worked.
He's a very early advocate of this in all.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I tell you, this fellow's so far ahead of his time. It's just tragedy that he's his age and can't put those wonderful ideas to work.
Mm.
Because he was just far ahead of his time.
Say he's still busy. Still doing
he's very busy. I think he's retired, but he's just doing freelance, and I think he's busier than ever.
Yeah, that's good.
He did quite a bit of work for Subaru.
That's right, yeah.
And they were so demanding that they were so terribly demanding of his time. They expected him to do something almost like a Rumpelstiltskin overnight.
Mm.
And he said it just got to the point, I can't work with you people.
Mm-hmm.
You're impossible. And I suppose that he did such fantastic things and got such wonderful results on such short notice that they just kept pulling ideas from him, and he just got to the point he couldn't take it anymore. So he just quit.
But in 47, he's at the height of his power.
Oh, yes. Alex dealt mostly with, in fact, neither Phil nor I had any meetings with Mr. Tucker,
mm-hmm.
other than maybe on the social occasions when they were showing someone through the building or the department, or we went out into the showroom or something. Also, Alex dealt with engineering, and we were adjacent to research.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but Alex did all of that.
I see.
Because, he was the boss.
Yeah.
And he was carrying out Tucker's orders, and he could work with research. And we did meet engineers like Mr. Rockelman and
Fred Rockelman.
Mm-hmm.
The old Ford.
Engineer. Fred Rockelman.
R O C K L E M.
M A N. I think he was from Pennsylvania. I think he had a big farm out in Pennsylvania.
He'd been sort of semi-retired when
he came along. And then I'm trying to think of the other fellow that was it, Mr. White, somebody who did the. Was it the water-cooled engine or something? He brought in this. Oh, I'm having a hard time recalling his.
They were considering a water-cooled engine.
Yes, and he came through and talked to us.
Yeah.
And then there was some fellow from Italy. I can't remember his name either, who was a real speed demon, and he came through and talked to Alex and Phil and myself. So we did get some. Information from outside, although design departments are usually under lock and key.
Yeah.
Not anybody can walk in there. And we, of course, were not allowed to go anywhere either.
You weren't allowed to go into the trim department and watch them.
Never. Mm-mm.
That's interesting.
The
probably
trim
wanted to.
Trim department brought their things to me.
Oh, they bring
of what they had done to get our approval and to see how we liked what they were doing.
That's good.
And it was nice, yes.
Yeah.
But
unusual, even though.
Right. Yeah. Well, just like when I worked for Lowy, we never went into any other part of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
We were under lock and key. So it's in a lot of ways it's good, and in a lot of ways it's very frustrating because you get so tired of not having anyone else to talk to. You can't.
Action.
No, they're just isn't possible.
It would have been great if you and the trim department could have
been
active.
Yeah.
I suppose the old practices and prejudices were still a bit.
People were always stealing one another's ideas, and I think that had a lot
see.
To do with it. And they didn't want somebody to come through and take a job for a while and steal the ideas and move on and carry them with them,
mm-hmm.
carry the ideas along with them, or techniques or whatever. And I'm sure the techniques were very important. So.
Of the 50 odd Tuckers that were actually made,
mm-hmm.
were they? Were they all handmade, or were they mass produced?
No, they were establishing their mass production.
They were, and they had.
I think the only real handmade one was the prototype. I think.
Original. And that still exists, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Tucker's having some problems from all sides. Did they filter into the design department?
Yes, they did. In fact, it was so troublesome to us to get drift of what was going on. Of course, all one had to do was read the newspaper and read Drew Pearson's column. He was the number one enemy.
Chicago papers plastered all over.
Oh, yes. They were having a heyday with it. And it was all a figment of this fellow's imagination. And, of course, as we know, he was ultimately proven innocent that he wasn't.
Too late.
But, yes, it was too late. But these troublesome things kept coming to us, and we... were very disturbed by it, to the point that we made signs and put up outside our office and said, "We ain't mad at nobody." We had to do something to break the tension.
Yeah.
Because tensions were really strong
for a while. What generated this hatred? Was it largely inspired by the big three?
I would imagine there was something that had come through from time to time. I'm sure they had gotten to the vendors. We were overcharged, as I understood it at the time, overcharged 4, 5, or 6 times for something from what it should be. It's like maybe a mold for a bumper. Maybe somebody else they could have done it for $50,000, but for Tucker they charge him $200,000, an exorbitant amount.
Right.
Now, as I say, I don't have total recall. These are not exact figures, but I'm just using this as a.
What fabric? Did you have any problem there with vendors?
I don't recall having any trouble with fabrics, but I know that engineering was having major problems, and of course, if they couldn't get these assemblies done, would hold up production, and it just filtered on down like dominoes through the whole place. That slowed everybody down and brought
us
to a halt.
Almost a calculated attempt to drive him out of the business.
I'm sure it was.
A concerted.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
We felt that all along the way that this was being done. And if one were there to read the articles, it was clearly a conjured up accusation.
Living through that and reading about it, and then reading about it in after years, it's incredible to me that the government pursued him like he was a criminal.
Well, when you understand the small amount of money that it would have taken to put the car in full production, was minuscule compared to what production costs are today for any one thing.
Right.
He was going to have a whole new car, and I think the industry had so much at stake, they had to make certain this car never came off the line.
Seemed almost like a conspiracy.
Oh yes, well, we were all convinced that it's what it was, and
it
could well be that maybe even Drew Pearson was paid to do these things. I'm sure that they're not.
He was one of your nemesis.
It was a sad thing because so much had gone into it. That it was a shame that it couldn't have come off, and of course, ultimately Tucker was cleared, and it was that. Well, I'm sorry. I guess I was wrong. They'd accomplished their purpose, whoever they are.
He was effectively out of the business.
He was effectively out of the business.
He'd become
disheartened. That's right.
And defeated.
Right. In fact, when we look at this, this sort of as a corollary, looking at John DeLorean's thing, the monies that he has spent were mega times from what Tucker was spending.
Yes.
And a lot of the ideas on his car were Tucker ideas, only exaggerated.
Right.
The gull wing,
mm-hmm.
what we had in our door sections were was a gull wing type thing, so that one could walk into the car without knocking his head off and that sort of thing. But there were, in looking at these things, when you think that how here's a man who did put money that was from stockholders into homes and apartments and that sort of thing. Tucker never did anything. I went to their apartment. I went there to work with Mrs. Tucker. Mrs. Tucker wanted me to design a heraldic crest using the logo from the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I took what I did. I took the working drawing of the logo and I made a heraldic crest out of the colors that she decided she wanted the crest to be, and I took it up to their apartment. And these people, well, it was a lovely apartment, they didn't live lavishly, it just wasn't their style. They're just nice people.
Nice small town people?
Yes, nice small town people.
Did you design the logo?
No, I did not design the logo.
Who did that, do you remember?
No, I don't. I was given the logo and told to work with it and change it any way I wanted and to do some different colors, ideas, or combinations, and sort of thing.
You should have resurrected your torpedo hood ornament.
Listen, there was a number of other companies that did that, took my torpedo and put
right.
it on their cars. I did see that floating around on many cars, yes.
Yeah.
Not many makes of cars. I don't know whether it was GM or who it was, but one of the companies had it, and I think it was General Motors.
You're right.
That had my torpedo. And it sounds so ridiculous to make such a big deal about a hood ornament, but when one considers that out of entire styling sections, How many people in that styling section ever get anything on a car?
Right.
They work for years and never get anything on a car. They do just work. They make drawings, they make paintings, and so on and so forth, but they never get anything on a car. I, at least, in my first attempt, I got something on a car.
Did you salvage one of those?
That's not that. Yes, well, not the hood ornament, but I had the original drawing, and that is another thing that I know that went off to Francis Ford Coppola's studio. I remember I had that original drawing that came back with the mark on it from the Studebaker meeting when they decided that's what they wanted. So that one.
Well, you've got you've got about 10 cars completed, and how are things going about mid-47?
Well, I think we were going along fine. Everything was go.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, we took one of the cars out and drove it around the parking lot and that sort of thing, and everything was go at that point. And as I recall, that was in the late spring, probably early summer, and everything was fine until suddenly the cracks began to appear in the wall, and it was no one had any enthusiasm. Everything was too depressing, and people began to disappear and move on. And
leave the company.
Leave the company.
Yeah, feeling that it was...
They knew they had to do something. As I recall, they accused him of not intending to bring out a car.
Really?
They accused him of just bilking the public, as I recall.
With a phony concept.
That he really didn't have any intention of putting on a car, which was totally untrue.
Was he selling stock in the company?
Yes, they had many. People really believed in him. Was the turnout, and there were a lot of little people that believed in him, and it's all we all did. We believed in him, and we still believe in him.
Mm-hmm.
Believed in him, and that was just a tragic accusation, and it could have been anything.
Drew Pearson and Homer Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. As I recall, they're the ones
pursuing him, or some sort of. They thought he was a charlatan.
Obviously, somebody I think had gotten to them, and I still think they were paid to do it. I think they were paid to do a job on Tucker. Frankly, is what I think, because after all, they had their reputations too, and if they had succeeded in really convicting him, that would have been a fantastic feather in their cap. So they took a total defeat when the jury couldn't find anything, and the judges couldn't find anything, any truth to this.
But by this time, he exhausted his finances and his
company,
energy.
Right.
The
energy
company
has
gone bankrupt.
I guess.
The models
something
have been
like
pounded
that.
By the government.
Everything was impounded.
It was just impossible to get it started.
Couldn't.
I think he did try, though, didn't he?
I think
half-heartedly.
The will wasn't there, the backing wasn't there, and he needed the confidence of the people. And of course, I think their confidence was probably blackened by all the accusations. And it did take its effect. It destroyed the man. It destroyed the company. And when we were trying to get our convention out here, and I wanted it, I thought this would be like coming back to Mecca or the place.
Sure.
Of the birth of the Tucker.
Ypsilanti.
The family didn't want it. The family was very reluctant.
Really?
I worked a whole year convincing these people we meant them no harm.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to create a wonderful reunion, and we wanted to pay tribute to Preston Tucker. And then when I told them what we planned to do, that we were going to have a ceremony over at the gravesite,
mm-hmm.
we had the gravestone refinished.
Yes.
And reset and... I think it was that made him realize that we were sincere in wanting to do something.
And the old home is still there.
And
too.
The old home, we went, we had the tour that went past the big machine shop in the old home, went out to the cemetery, and we had a little service, and one of our men, who is a very fine religious man, one of the members of the club, said a little prayer, and
mm-hmm.
it was a very nice, we had 48 red carnations. We couldn't afford roses, so we took red carnations, and each club member that was there put some flowers on the grave to commemorate the 48, the car 48. So,
the dynamic, visionary person. It seemed a shame that his career was so blunted,
yes.
So abruptly, and so deliberately.
I'm sure it was deliberate. I think that's a very good word.
The car was well engineered too, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's
they had a fine engineer. They had Carl Doman, who is also from this area.
D-O-M-A-N.
Mm-hmm. Very fine engineer.
Another Michiganian?
Yes, and also another good one was Warren Rice,
mm-hmm.
who lived over in Dexter. He died about 3 years ago.
These were all of associates at Tucker
mm-hmm.
from Michigan days.
I think from way back, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they all had some wonderful talent.
And of course you have Alex Tremonis, who was
Alex
turning out the design.
Right.
And you were doing interiors.
Mm-hmm.
And who else was involved in design?
Phil Egan. And Phil
was
from Illinois.
Background.
I think he was either from Winnetka, Glencoe, one of those areas, one of those suburbs of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very fine designer. And I think he used to work for George Walker, but I'm not sure.
Oh.
But the Walker keeps ringing bells.
Mm-hmm.
And he now
Walker's
has...
Walker's a well-known industrial mm-hmm. designer those days.
And Phil was a very quiet, very studious, very capable fellow. And I believe he has his own business now in California.
Still
mm-hmm. And Joe Thompson, the fellow who got me started in the industry, he's passed away now because he would be around 100, I guess, if he were still alive.
Yeah.
But he had a fine job out in California, and I think it was the Art Students League.
Oh, yeah.
And he taught the clay modeling and car design and so on for years, and his students adored him.
What did he do at Tucker?
He was head of model making.
Model making?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was a marvelous clay modeler.
Uh-huh.
Oh, he was, I guess there were none better.
Did you go through the classic routine in those days, making 3/8 quarter model?
Oh, yes, yes.
Clays or plaster?
Well, it was clay put on a wood, what do you call that? The core, yeah. The buck was wood,
mm-hmm.
and then we piled the clay on, and mm-hmm. the clay would be extruded from this machine that heated it, and sometimes mm-hmm. it was so hot it would burn your hand, so you threw it quickly, so that's why we called it throwing clay.
You had a heater and an extruder, though.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That was
pretty good stuff.
Oh, yes. So you moved it fast when it came out of there.
Did you get to do any of the clay modeling?
Oh, yes.
Did
you?
Yes. Oh,
uh-huh.
Great, yeah.
Right, I had never done any clay modeling before,
uh-huh.
so it was interesting. I made all kinds of things. In fact, I have a plaster cast of a little gentleman that I modeled out of clay, and I had the boys make a plaster model of it for me.
You haven't got a plaster model of it?
No, I don't have anything.
Did any of those survive? Any of those? Clay, of course, doesn't survive as long.
Clay wouldn't.
Any plaster?
But I don't really know where they would be. Have you ever talked to Bob Cotto? He would know more about those
things.
I mean to.
Yeah.
He could probably clarify some of that. Because
yeah.
I don't know whatever happened to those. This one picture I have here shows how these are clay. Most of these are clay with paint over.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Those are 1/8.
Are these the Studebaker or the Tuckers?
Those are Studebaker, but yeah. That's the way it's done.
Yes, right. Uh-huh.
So, in fact, I had one picture of our model that we had in the design department that was made of clay and painted, but I don't have those pictures either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're getting intimations that things are not going well. What was your reaction to that?
Well, heartbreak, I would say, heartbreak.
Yeah.
Because I had loved Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely adored it. I never met so many nice people. Everybody was nice in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Whatever they say about Chicagoans being nice, you believe it because it's true. They're just good people. In fact, years later, I was in Tennessee, and my car was parked in front of a store. And I was selling merchandise, and I had parked my car in front of a store, and I had a Studebaker at that time, and it had Illinois tags on it. And when I came out, there was a man leaning on the car, and he said, "I see you've got Illinois tags on this car." I said, "Yes, I have an apartment in Chicago, and I work out of Chicago." And he said, "Well, I want to tell you something." He said, "During the war, I was stationed in Chicago," and he said, "I never met so many wonderful people in my life." He said, "No matter when I went to have a drink, when I went to eat, or a hotel, or anything," he said, "I never paid a penny." He said, the people of Chicago paid for my stay there. And he said, I want to do something nice for somebody from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I own this record store, and I want you to come in and select any album of your choice.
Oh,
I said, well, you're very generous, but I do not have a record player, and I'm not home long enough to even invest in one. So I said, why don't you keep that offer for somebody else who comes along with Illinois tags in their car? But they were wonderful people. And so when this happened, to get back to your question, when this happened, I was devastated because it meant then moving on.
What about the rest of the staff? Maybe Tremulous and others? What
well, Tremulous, of course, was a native of Chicago.
Oh, was it?
Yes. Yeah. He and Chrissy were natives. And although they didn't live with their parents were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just meant a matter of their just staying at home or staying in Chicago.
How about the rest of your colleagues?
Phil went, I don't know where Phil went, and I didn't know anybody else too well.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, the place became quieter and quieter, and finally we got the word that.
Did the end come fairly soon after that?
It came, as I recall, kind of gradually.
We kept trying to do something.
Trying to do something, and then it just got to the point we got the word that.
Were you all being paid?
Well, yes, as long as we were there, we were paid.
The
oh,
payroll
yes.
was met, huh?
Oh, yes. We were never wanting, huh?
They turned out about 50 odd cars?
It was either 50 or 51. It seems to be some sort of dispute on whether that one was a complete car
or not.
Car.
So somebody's got it anyway.
Something happened, yes.
Someone's got the first prototype.
John Limmel, who's now the president of this little Tucker car, or Tucker Club. He has the what they call the Tin Goose, and it's now up for sale. And he has another car that he's working on.
Is it a drivable prototype?
Yes.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
He has two.
Doesn't want to go too far, but you don't expect too much of it. But he's done a wonderful job. He and a fellow named Ulatowski have worked on it just night and day, and they've got it in really great shape. So it looked good, and it was interesting because the design of that, of the prototype, was slightly different from the other cars.
Yes, right.
Maybe you noticed that opening in the back, the
so.
Mm-hmm, was right. different shape.
But it was Alec Tremulous's basic design, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. I would think so, yes.
With the input from
with
the Tuckers.
Input, well, Tucker first got his ideas across to another person. I can't recall who the other person was, and they
the
did
first
some
designer.
Work, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't doing things the way Tucker wanted, so he got rid of him, and he got Alex.
Mm-hmm.
And they got the car totally designed and ready for production in 100 days. So, and Alex said, how do we ever get all this done? And I said, I don't know.
Were you involved in that? You were
in
that
part of that.
Days.
And I said, Alex, you recall we never took a coffee break.
Probably not a dinner, but lunch.
And so I'm sure when Alex was working, which was longer hours than when either Phil or I were working, that he went without many meals.
Mm. Well, it was a sad conclusion to a glorious experiment.
Yes, it certainly is.
The cars were, I guess, impounded by the government initially, were they not?
I believe they were, and then
later
people,
released
yeah,
them.
Later released to people who purchased them and so on.
Well, Mr. Tucker did not survive that that experiment. He did live for a number of years afterwards.
Not too long after that.
Really?
I think he died at age 53, I believe.
In the early 50s?
Yes, but I think he was in his early 50s. I think he was around 53
so
when he
the
died.
Early 1950s, was it?
Oh, that would be, yes,
yeah.
Late 40s, early 50s.
He was completely vindicated.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Did the government offer any retribution?
No, of course, he never got anything.
Neither
he nor the family.
Did you ever think of suing them?
I don't know. It was hard to get information out of the family. I asked him a lot of questions.
His resources were probably limited by this time.
Well, yes, I think so.
Because of the legal fees.
Well, I understood that his wife had to take a job in a motel,
finally,
because everything they tried to do was so costly. And he had lost everything in trying to clear his name.
Yeah.
And the whole family was united in trying to help him. So. It was heartbreaking for the entire family.
So, again, you're looking for a job.
Looking for a job, right.
Sometime in late 47?
Yes, it had to be late 47. be late 47, right. And I accepted a job at that time with, some veterans group wanted an industrial designer to lecture to veterans. They were having these veterans colleges all over. So I said I would do that. And I asked them how I was to get paid. And they said, well, you'll be well paid if we decide to keep you. Now, we have a number of people that we're trying to do this. And if the students like them, they get along well, and then we'll keep you on. Well, then you'll get paid like maybe once a month. I said, well, I have to have better than that. I said, I can't live on a once-a-month salary. I said, I've got to get paid at least every 2 weeks. But I said, I'll come down and I'll lecture to the students, and I did. They loved it, and I took drawings down. We had a big blackboard, and I was telling them different things that they could do and how to approach a subject and so on. They loved it. So they asked me to come back again. So I thought, well, I'm doing really well. And I had to take the IC from where I lived on the south side up to the Loop. And these were night schools. And I didn't get out of these night classes until sometimes midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And traveling alone was pretty scary business.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it for 3 nights, and I got the word that what they were doing was they were using people. I'm sure the school was collecting from the government for instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And they put people on this so-called, quote, trial basis, close quote.
Mm-hmm.
And then say, sorry, you didn't meet up, and they'd take somebody else in this way. They could string a thing along and get money from the government, but never pass it on to anyone. So I was getting desperate at that point, and I didn't want to go home, and I didn't want to ask my mother for money. So I went to a employment service and asked them to help me find a job. And it was through them that I got a job interview with a corset company who was looking for a designer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was
hired. Were you still work Parsons in those days?
Oh, very much so, very much so. And so I was hired, and I went to work in the design department, and that was a bust. That was terrible. I could see I was never going to do anything but pick up pins off the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, this is not for me. I'll go back, and maybe I can get that job at International Harvester I had talked to before. But so I went and I quit. And they said, well, they didn't want me to quit. They wanted me to try something else. They said, we sort of like your background. You've got an interesting background. We'd like you to stay with the firm. So they said, how about going out and doing promotional work for us? I said, I've never done anything like that.
Was it a fairly well-known line of...
Oh, yes. Was the Formfit Company. Formfit Company is a big outfit. So I went out and I did some promotional work for them. And one of the places I worked that I liked real well was a corset house on State Street. They had 3 floors
in Chicago
on State Street. And I would go there and I would tell women, analyze their figures and tell them what they need and all that. And I knew very little about corsetry. So I'd never worn anything like that in my life.
But you had a sense of structure and design. Yeah.
But yes, I knew about design. And of course, they gave me a quick course in how to fit.
Yeah.
Take measurements to fit and different figure types. And it's when you break it down, it's kind of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just was a matter of getting the confidence of the customer and getting them in the fitting room, putting them into the hands of the corseteer. So I did that, and I loved it. That was great.
Yeah.
I just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So then they sent me all over, and I went to Kansas City and St. Louis, and I did other places in Chicago. They sent me to Atlanta, and so, I don't know, I came back from one of the trips, and they said, you sort of fit in with selling.
Mm-hmm.
How would you like to take a line out and see if you can sell it? So I
a
took
their
merchandise.
Foundation garments.
Yeah. So I did that, and I called on the customers and sold to merchants. And
you were successful?
Oh, yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. They called me the star.
Good.
Because I got the biggest increase in within that next year of anybody on the sales force.
Army of saleswomen?
Oh, yes, they had a tremendous sales force, and they were mostly women.
Mm-hmm.
Some men, but mostly women.
Most days it probably would have been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they were unique. Most companies don't have saleswomen, they have salesmen. And I worked for this company for 3 years, and then I went to work for another company, a New York firm. That was when I went over to see Mr. Loy, was when I was sent to New York. And I got that job through this man, this first man that I worked with on State Street, It had this three-story corset house.
Was it still Form-Fit, or was it another?
No, Form-Fit didn't own this corset shop on State Street. But this man was, he knew all these different companies, and he knew this one in New York was called Biancholi. It was a very expensive line.
How do you spell it?
Biencjolie, Biancholi.
Yeah.
Very expensive line of foundations. And he said, well, he would like me, Mr. Yaffe, who was the owner of the company, had talked with this man on State Street. And he said he would like to have me come in to possibly work in the design department.
Sure.
So I said, well, I didn't like...
The whole foundation business was exploding at this point.
Oh, yes. Tremendous.
Things, yeah.
So then I went to New York, and they had one other, I think they had one other saleswoman, and the rest were all men.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I didn't want to work in their styling section. I didn't.
Really?
It was too confining, and...
Like a sweatshop.
Yeah, and you'd never got... Yeah, the machine's going all the time, yeah. Because you had the special. You didn't work in the factory now. The factory was over in New Jersey, but their styling department was in conjunction with a workroom, and you just hear these motors going zoom, 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 zoom.
They could instantly transmit your design.
Right, oh yeah, right there,
yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
And the models, they tried everything on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not for me. I enjoyed this freedom. I enjoyed getting out and going places. So I stayed on their sales force and for the next, I think, 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
15 years.
Which company?
Biancholi, the one from New York.
Oh.
And I spent... a month in New York in the summer and a month in the middle of the winter. And I worked with people from Europe and the United Kingdom. And
that's
so
nice.
It was
Do you remember
nice.
Designing any? You were largely in sales.
I didn't design anything.
Would you like to, if you'd had more freedom, would you like to stay in design?
Yes, I would have. Mm-hmm. But I could see the freedom wasn't there.
Yeah.
The freedom wasn't there. Both Form-Fit Company and Biancholi had a top designer. Both of them had a core of designers, wonderful talent that wasn't getting anywhere.
Yeah.
And you were going to have to wait until that person died off.
Mm.
And as it turned out, the one woman in Chicago lived to be 89 and stayed there until she died. And the one in New York, see, when did she die? Oh, she was must have been 70s or in her 70s. Now, mind you, I was, in my 40s.
There was no room to move up.
Nobody ever did. As long as I was with that firm in New York, nobody ever moved anywhere.
You were obviously very successful as a salesperson.
Well, I enjoyed it. Yes, I did very well. Mm-hmm.
In design, the design director would sketch out the new line and the seamstress would take over. That.
Would take over and make it up, and then they had models.
Models who would keep trying.
And they would come in and talk to us, and how did we like this, and what do we think about that? And
mm-hmm.
Of course, they had their big shows, as I say, twice a year, when the whole new line would come out,
mm-hmm.
and we'd have a chance to use it. And of course, then they got so that they gave us garments to wear, so we could see how we liked them.
Mm-hmm.
We women, I think there were about three of us, and the rest were all men, so their wives wore them.
Some of those. Did you get into outer underwear, like chemise and teddies?
No, that was more the lingerie.
Oh, strictly foundation.
Yeah, this is strictly controlled garments.
Did you have anything to do with the emergence of the panty girdle?
Oh yes,
I
would
think you
were.
Oh, yeah.
Very definitely.
Yeah.
In fact,
about
this
time.
Oh yes, we were given panty girdles to wear to see how we liked them.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so we came up with the idea of having them so that you could remove them or adjust them or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Oh yes.
Zippers,
mm-hmm.
And
yes, right.
Yeah. That was really a breakthrough in
yes,
foundation
for sanitary wear. Now, some of the things that they were just trying in those days are just everyday occurrences.
Yeah.
But
in some instances, you were out selling the line of fairly innovative.
Always had a new line.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But we maintained certain numbers from year to year because a customer got to used to wearing a certain garment. They weren't about to give it up, and if you dropped that out of the line, there were plenty of complaints. So, so they kept some numbers in, but it was then I did an awful lot of traveling then.
You said something about sanitary. Did you get into hospital type?
No.
None of that.
No. The company that I work for finally came in with a light maternity garment, but they didn't stick with it.
Yeah.
They didn't stick with it. It was mostly high fashion. And they began working with, was it Anne Klein? And somebody, I can't think now, who was a top, she was a, talk about being top of the chart, she was a top of the charts of,
yeah.
Of women's wear. And certain garments. See, what you did was you went in and talked to a woman, if you will only control your figure, you can wear certain outer garments
right.
that were impossible to wear otherwise.
Yeah.
And when they would see how they would look, like, I think the, one of the famous strapless things was Warner's. That was a competitive
right.
virus, but the
sure.
Warner's a Merry Widow.
Sure.
And that type of thing.
Yeah.
That wasn't Anne Klein. Who was it? Anne? Somebody or other. I've forgotten now. But we worked with fashion, with outer fashion.
So
collaborating.
This was the era of getting away from the bone, to,
mm-hmm.
not the bone, but the heavy girdle.
Heavy garments, just lightweight, but
lightweight,
mm-hmm.
but still.
But the structure of the garment did the
spandex
controlling.
It
was out. Yeah, spandex came in.
Yeah.
That was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of a rubberized nylon.
Mm-hmm.
And,
sheer, lightweight.
Sheer, lightweight. Yeah.
But by construction, could be because controlling is something with bones.
And the bras also were
oh, yes.
a revolution.
Oh yes.
Too. They were no longer the bulky thing.
No. No, and they began to take in what they called cup size. Women
right.
before all wore
yes.
whatever there was.
This must have
mainly
been quite
things flatten them down.
Innovation, getting women to own up to various cup sizes.
Well, yes. In fact, a lot of women didn't know, and this was part of the job that one did in as a demonstrator, promoter.
Right.
It was to go into a store, and that particular store would advertise the fact that you were going to be
right.
there. Bring your figure problems.
Sure.
And let our expert help you.
So, reader, you were a figure consultant.
Yes. In fact, I never will forget one time I was doing a promotion, and I think it was down in Georgia, and this woman came in, and I asked her what size bra she wore, and she said, well, I never wear a bra. And I said, well, wouldn't you be more comfortable with a bra? She's a pretty good size woman. And she looked awfully big around the middle, and I measured her, and gee, she was big. So I said, well, let's go in the fitting room and let me see what your situation is. I can measure you better if I can put the tape measure next to your skin. And I went in, and here is this woman with these tremendous, pendulous bazooms
mm-hmm.
stuck in her corset.
Good.
That's why she was so big around the middle. But imagine the pain.
Oh, horrible.
She didn't know anything. Somebody saw the ad and had her come in like a daughter or something.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
When she got through, I never will forget that woman.
And you fixed
I put her in a 36C bra, and I think the girdle was something like a 28. Because here's this woman who's big like this.
Right.
But she didn't know any better.
You must have heard the story of Howard Hughes designed a special bra for Jane Russell in The Outlaw. Ever heard this story?
No.
He sat down on the drawing board and engineered her a special bra because of her full-breasted figure, so that it would be shown off to his best advantage.
To his best advantage.
Well, his best advantage. He thought to her best advantage, but his best advantage.
Well, when I worked for FormFit, they did a special designs for Liz Taylor. She was just a young girl, and she had very large,
yes.
what they decided were either D or E size bosoms.
Uh-huh, right.
And so they designed bras for her.
Ah, yeah. Then of course, I guess Jane Russell is now a spokesman for
Cross Your Heart.
Cross Your Heart.
Is that exquisite
full figured,
form?
Full-figured
yeah.
bra. Yeah.
Was that exquisite form?
May well have been.
Something like that.
Yeah, right.
The Cross Your Heart, I think that was exquisite
yeah.
form. So.
Still a big industry.
Oh, yes, right.
Gosh, the one about the ladies wearing those snug derriere devices now.
To make them look like they have fannies
yeah.
where they
well,
don't?
Well, that, of course, but I mean the one you see on television a lot where it really shapes, well, in any event, it's still very popular. The fact that people using devices to
I'm sure they do
to slim their derriere and other areas, and so that must have been a fascinating industry for you.
It was all business, I can
yeah.
tell you that.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of hard work. It was all business, and it was interesting because I would deal with either the store owner or the store manager,
mm-hmm.
together with the buyer or buyers, and then with the staff. So it was interesting.
So after that 17 years, it's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Were you married during this period?
Through part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Through
yeah.
part of it. And the reason I got out of the industry was the firm that I worked for in New York was hiring a salesperson to represent them permanently over in London.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I was married, I traveled all during the week, came home on weekends.
Yeah.
I applied for the job, and I said, I know the work well, and I know the buyers. I've been working with them here
mm-hmm.
in New York. Let me have the job. And the man said, no, you're married. And I said, so I can fly back home. If I can fly over there, I can fly home.
Mm-hmm.
No difference in driving all day from Indianapolis to Ann Arbor, so what difference does it make? And they said, well, they thought they wanted somebody else, and so they asked me the name of a friend of mine. I said, you don't even know whether or not she's as qualified as I am. I feel I am more qualified. I've had more experience. I know your line better. She doesn't know your line at all. I know the customers. She doesn't know these customers, because they were some pretty high-powered customers. I worked with Saks Fifth Avenue buyers, and there's nobody any sharper than Saks Fifth Avenue buyers to work with. And so when they didn't give me the job, I quit. And they weren't in business too much after that. The owner was old, and he was kind of riding the company out.
In the few minutes we have left, Audrey, do you think you could sort of sum up your feelings about having been in on the, almost on the ground floor of females doing industrial design?
Well, now that I know about ERA and all that sort of thing, if I had known about it, then I would have thought, yay for me.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, it was a matter of I just needed a job.
Mm-hmm.
I knew how to draw. I was a good draftsperson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just what I knew. I did what I knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt there wasn't anything out there they couldn't teach me that I wasn't capable of learning. I've never felt inferior in any way. So I suppose that one has to have some sort of self-confidence. And my mother was always saying, you can do it,
and you did.
And so I did what I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I didn't do too badly, because people have come along since, and women are still being given a chance, and women are still being discriminated against to some degree.
Yeah.
But nevertheless,
your career was a breakthrough.
It was a breakthrough, and I worked with such wonderful people. Exner couldn't have been nicer. He was a wonderful man to work with, and he certainly was a talented man.
Mm-hmm.
Alex was a love to work with. He was just a joy. I just felt privileged to be around anyone with such fantastic ideas and ability. I just feel I've been very lucky,
mm-hmm.
very, very lucky. And when people tell me that I probably was the first, I'm not sure, but they tell me I probably was the first.
Very close to
me. I think, well, okay. But it never occurred to me at any time.
Interested to, I was hoping you would have said that sometime you would have wanted to work for someone like George Walker or Norman Bel Geddes, or later on, to